Hey, everybody, this is Seth Davis. I'm officially announcing the launch of, you guessed it, the Seth Davis Podcast on the SI Podcast Network. It's going to be a series of long-form interviews, smart conversations with interesting people. Yes, my ballywick is college hoops, but I plan to interview people from all across the sporting spectrum. So we're going to learn a lot, but mostly we're going to have some fun on the Seth Davis Podcast. Talk to you soon, everybody.
Look for new episodes every Tuesday, and remember to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Today's episode of Open Floor is brought to you by Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. Ben, what's your Mack Weldon experience?
Well, look, I'm pretty picky in general about everything. I'm sure you probably have noticed that about me. But when it comes to sweatpants, number one, do they look good? Number two, are they comfortable? Number three, do they ship quickly? Mack Weldon was 3 for 3. I'm wearing my sweatpants right now. Actually, I was filming a video earlier today wearing a suit and a shirt on top and my Mack Weldon sweatpants below. They're that comfortable. I wear them all the time. I love them.
Perfect. That's what they're going for. And it's not just sweatpants. You can also get socks. I actually heard great things about the socks, so I regret not getting those. But shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and all of the products are naturally antimicrobial, which means you can wear them for 3 or 4 days and you're fine.
And we both do, even though admitting that is too much information. People should go to MackWeldon.com, type in the promo code OPEN, O-P-E-N. That's 20% off. Nice and simple. MackWeldon.com, promo code OPEN.
That's great. We're both sweatpants people, so we're big believers in the Mack Weldon product. So check it out.
There's a reason they picked us to talk about them. We're experts.
Yeah, exactly. We're squarely in the demographic. All right, let's get into it.
I am so ready. Let's talk hoops.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. We got DeMar DeRozan winning Player of the Week honors. We got Klay Thompson not being traded to the Celtics. And Andrew Wiggins went nuts this weekend, and I'm surprised that wasn't the first words out of your mouth is, look at these young Timberwolves, they're back.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I was actually pretty pumped, but I was torn last night because they also destroyed my Lakers, so it was a complicated night in my living room.
That was a tough episode of Nick Young's Defensive Player of the Year TV show, wasn't it?
I mean, I think it was more D'Angelo had a rough second half trying to keep up with Andrew Wiggins.
Yeah, he's had a rough year on that end, but that's okay.
That was to be expected. But no, we should start. Before we got on this podcast, you were emailing fact checkers from Sports Illustrated because you've got a story in the magazine this week. Why don't you talk a little bit about what you wrote about?
Okay, so last week we kind of talked about they had a brand new arena there in Sacramento, and Cousins is still sort of in this frustrating cycle where, you know, he starts these games off incredibly well, and then it just something inevitably goes wrong. He gets frustrated and the whole cycle begins again the next night. And the very next night after we talked about the Kings losing to the Lakers, they go up to Portland. Cousins gets into this shoving match with Myers Leonard. You know, everybody's kind of targeting him again with the physical play. He puts on a spectacular effort. And then what do you know, in overtime, Rudy Gay bricks a terrible jumper at the buzzer and they lose. And he stomps off the court frustrated again. And it's like, when will this cycle ever end? So as I was writing the story, which isn't just about Cousins, but it's about some of these other stranded superstars, guys like John Wall, Anthony Davis, and even Paul George, you know, guys who are sort of franchise players on teams that are off to slow starts this year, and maybe right. they've been left behind a little bit, you know, by these super teams. I started to really think about Cousins. The more I thought about it, I think it's actually in the best interest of the Kings to trade him now. I don't even think this is a situation of they have to trade him. I actually believe, upon reflection, that they're better off trading him. They should just move forward.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what I talked about on the last show after we got done with the State of America, the State of Boogie. I've been entrenched in the trade him now camp for the last year or so, just because I feel like his value is highest now. But talk a little bit more about what you learned, like talking to Kings people.
Yeah, well, so first of all, I've always been sort of in the situation of like, I think Cousins will be happier somewhere else. Like, he's never going to come out and admit that. He's a very loyal person. He's kind of made that clear over the years.
Right.
But, like, a trade makes sense from his standpoint, and you could see why teams would want to trade for him given his talent, right? Like, if you have the right situation, if you have a John Wall to pair him with in Washington, or you've got some other young pieces around him, like, theoretically it would work better, and so you could see why teams would be interested in him. The hang-up is always, in these situations, it's sort of the team that only has the one star. You know, Boogie is everywhere on their big screen. I mean, the jerseys, you know, the whole franchise is sort of wrapped up in him, just like the Blazers are wrapped up in Damian Lillard, just like the Pacers are wrapped up in Paul George, just like the Pelicans are wrapped up in an Anthony Davis, the Thunder and Russell Westbrook. I mean, yeah. We see this everywhere. Problem is, I think, and this was expressed to me by some people who used to be with the franchise recently, was that you have this weird dynamic with Cousins where, you know, he is the be-all, end-all, but because nobody quite knows how to act around him, or they can't really predict what his behavior is going to be, and because, you know, his behavior does tend to get, you know, fairly irrationally emotional very quickly, Everybody's kind of like constantly walking on eggshells, right? But at the same time, he has this really generous side to him, which his agency people have been telling me about for a long time. Other people close to him have really kind of like harped on this. It's like, this dude does way more than he needs to in the community. There's a lot of random acts of kindness. He's paid for people's funerals. He's done the hospital visits without being asked to. He just goes completely above and beyond, especially locally there, but also where he's from in Alabama. So it creates this weird dichotomy where the franchise itself is like very appreciative of who he is and the commitment that he's made, right? In all these different ways.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they're always kind of like almost living in fear of what's going to happen next. And then there's this constant disappointment of, well, he's really, really, really good, but he's not quite good enough to do it by himself, even to a level where it's sort of respectable, right? Like, he's not carrying them to 41 to 45 wins and, you know, kind of helping them have this positive atmosphere. So it kind of creates a situation where I really think it's one of those things where when you're in it, you kind of can't see the dysfunctional side of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. The way you describe him, he kind of reminds me of like prime Rasheed Wallace, because depending on who you talk to or who you read and what you heard about Rasheed, because they're like, when he was in Portland and when he was in Detroit, like, he would do various charity drives and coat drives in Philadelphia and would actively fight like media attention and didn't want people to talk about his charitable side. But then at the same time, you could talk to people or hear from people around the league. Like, I've heard stories after the fact that he was just like miserable to deal with. And it really just sort of depended on who you talk to on a certain day in terms of like what people thought of him. And that to me is sort of where Boogie is. And of course, Sheed, like, once he went to the Pistons and found a situation that made sense for him, like, he won a title.
For sure. And I think part of the problem when you're in these situations, and just to reinforce what you said, that's exactly how they portray Cousins. He doesn't want the attention for the good things that he's doing. In fact, he actively fights against it, right?
Yeah.
So there are people who want to advocate on his behalf who have now just kind of like thrown their hands up in the air and saying, well, we can't get him the attention that he deserves for the things that he is doing because he doesn't want it. And so we're not going to go against his wishes. And I completely understand that from both sides. I think when you're too close to the situation is that you can't really envision life without him, right? But I do think when you look at this Kings roster, I mean, number one, I think we've got a pretty solid coach in place there with Jaeger, right?
Like, right.
I think he's got a pretty good understanding of how to get the most out of his guys. He's player friendly, relatable. Nobody comes out and blasts him in the media over the years that I've seen. I think number two, you've got... We've joked about it. You have a lot of young big men assembled, right? Like,
yeah.
If you do trade Cousins, it's going to be a step back. But you've got guys who you can work and develop. And I think you've got a player in Willie Cauley-Stein who could potentially be one of these mobile centers of the modern era, quote unquote, who could be a starting quality guy for you not too far down the road, right?
Yeah.
Now, the wings and the guards, obviously, to me, are incredibly weak, even with some of the additions that they've made. But that's sort of what you would be targeting if you do trade Cousins, right?
For sure.
So I don't see why you couldn't trade Cousins and, if you had a better roster balance, you took a year to develop some of these young players, I don't understand. Number one, I think it would be a big relief for everybody emotionally and psychologically to just move forward and to try something new. I think it would be scary right off the bat, but I think it could be a relief. And I think number two, you could get a better roster balance with the trade if you go big for small, and you could have a team that's, you know, competitive and frisky not too far, you know, into the future. I don't think it's going to have to be a four-year waiting teardown thing where, you know, you're at square one on the rebuilding program if you trade Cousins. And just because you don't have an all-star of his caliber doesn't mean you can't have a quality roster.
100%. And I think, like, the central issue for the Kings is that they've been in win-now mode for at least 2 years and have made moves to win now and make the playoffs, and they're not winning. So if that's where you are, like, it's time to come up with a plan B. And I think Cousins is one of the more attractive plan Bs in the league. Is like, if you deal him, you can get back a lot of assets to start over with. They still have, it's hard for them to rebuild entirely because they have pick swaps with the Sixers. So like, but the Sixers are bad enough so that even if you are giving up the better of the two lottery picks, you're still going to be like firmly in the top 10 there. And I don't know, I think it would be a smart move for everyone involved in Sacramento. But what else were you talking about in the story? Because it wasn't just Boogie, and I want to rank the stranded superstars on this episode and talk about guys around the league. So who else were you mentioning?
Yeah, so I basically focused on four guys, and I'll explain why I picked these four. I mean, it was Cousins, it's Paul George, it's John Wall, and it's Anthony Davis. All four of those guys play in front of home crowds that are below the NBA's average. All four play for teams that have very spotty sort of histories. You know, when you add up their franchises, they've actually changed their names more times than they've won titles over the last 50 years, you know, so that's always kind of a bad sign. These are franchises that regularly struggle to compete for sort of premium free agents. And there are franchises that have at least tried to make it work, you know, in one way or another, whether it's coaching changes, whether it's off-season investments. And then, unfortunately, when we look, you know, 2-3 weeks into the season, all four have really been, number one, below 500, but in some cases, you know, much worse than that, especially the Pelicans and the Wizards right now. And so those are situations where these are all four guys who, you know, by the NBA's salary structure, they are success stories, right? They played great on their rookie deals. They signed 4 or 5 year long-term contract extensions. They cashed in money beyond their wildest dreams. But when they did that, they basically sacrificed all their leverage and they kind of turned their futures over to these organizations. And in Paul George's case, that was okay. I mean, he had, you know, quite a bit of success early, but now you're starting to see that unravel. They're trying to change the team there in Indiana. You know, so how does, you know, what does that mean for him? Are these just going to be wasted years of his prime? You look at John Wall, it's kind of been a real roller coaster there. And then really with Anthony Davis, it's like people can't even celebrate what he's doing because they're too busy pitying him. And he's got 5 more years of this, right? Before he can even become an unrestricted free agent. Like, that's kind of a scary proposition. I mean, think about how long of a time that is. And we really have no evidence to expect it's going to get meaningfully better for him over the course of his contract based on their recent track record.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a story about how, you know, the guys who are sort of a little bit older than this generation, because all four of these guys are under 27. You know, the Kevin Durants and the Steph Currys and the LeBron James of the world, clearly this is their league, right? But they have left this younger generation stuck behind them, trying to kind of find a fit or try to find a reason for hope. And right now, you know, a few weeks into the season already, it's looking pretty dire.
Yeah, it is certainly looking dire for a couple of them. I mean, and we had talked about this last year. I think it's one trend with the NBA is that there are two kinds of successful teams in the league right now. There are sort of the super teams who obviously, like, when you put two or three of these guys together, it's really, really tough to stop. And that has been a model for team building around the league since LeBron, since the Celtics, really. But then the other side of it is there are teams like the Hawks, there are teams like the Hornets who are just really well coached and know how to win and do it with sort of more role players and lesser stars. And I think the problem is that right now, when you look around the league, there are a lot of great, great players who are stuck on teams that don't necessarily have that like institutional competence. So it is like, it's a great trend to highlight because it's an issue. I mean, it's not healthy for the league that I would say probably half of like the best 15 guys are stuck in bad situations.
Yeah, in fact, four of the SI Top 100's top 20 are these guys, right? I mean, they're all in our top 20. And let's also say Adam Silver has acknowledged this is a problem, right? Like after Kevin Durant signed with the Warriors, he basically said, like, we want competitive balance as a league. This is not something that I'm in favor of, this kind of accumulation of talent. We realize this is going to leave some teams behind. And to your point about, you know, successful management and sort of institutional competence. I mean, people like to kind of clown Sam Presti and Daryl Morey both in Oklahoma City and Houston, but those guys have pretty consistently put winning products on the court. And look at the Thunder already this year. I mean, it's not like they didn't skip a beat, but they haven't collapsed, right? That says something about your that says something about your management. And those guys are pretty shrewd in terms of building around their star players. Now, if you're a superstar, you're 23 years old, you've signed a five-year deal, and you have the choice, would you like to tie the next half decade of your life to Sam Presti's decision-making or Ernie Grunfeld's decision-making? Which direction do you go?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's why certainly, that's why at the time this summer, I couldn't blame Kevin Durant for not even taking a meeting with the Wizards, because it's just like, you look at the direction of the franchise and some of the pieces on that roster, I don't blame anyone who says, you know what, I'm not going to trust my prime with this organization. And that's fine, you know, it is what it is. But I've got a list of eight stranded superstars that I want to rank here. There are the four that you mentioned, Anthony Davis, John Wall, Boogie Cousins, Paul George. I am going to throw in James Harden and Russell Westbrook. We also have Carmelo Anthony. And then at the end, Harrison Barnes for the Dallas Mavericks.
No, come on.
I'm just kidding.
Wait, no, if USA Basketball hadn't already tacked him on, that would have been the ultimate tack on of his life.
I'm just kidding. Not Barnes. Although he's been great to start the season. So I think he's a solid piece. Speaking of which, actually, before we get into this, had Barnes signed with the Lakers, that would be a pretty intriguing mix right now.
You wanted to say they'd win the title this year, didn't you?
No. But look, it would be, they would have.
You wanted to.
It would have been a good fit. That's all I'm going to say. And hindsight is 20/20, but it would have made a lot of sense. And it's also something that we would have been relentless about this summer if the Lakers had given him $95 million. But no, the eighth is Jimmy Butler. So our list is Anthony Davis, James Harden, Russell Westbrook, John Wall, Boogie, Paul George, Carmelo, and Jimmy Butler.
Okay, can I just have one point before we start dissecting the list?
Okay.
Remember that guys like Westbrook and Harden both negotiated and extended their contracts right over the summer.
Yeah.
So they have made choices to recommit to their organization. So I think that's a key distinction from some of the younger guys that I mentioned, which is basically those younger guys are stuck whether they wanted to be or not. They can't get out. These guys have now recommitted and they've taken big raises to do it, but they at least have had some decision, you know, part of their future, right? And then with Carmelo, everybody knows. I mean, obviously, he chose to stay in New York. He kind of, you know, more or less forced his way to New York out of Denver. And then he took his free agency meetings. He flew across the country and then he re-signed with the Knicks, knowing what their limitations were as a franchise. So those guys are absolutely stuck and kind of left behind as well. And I think to a certain degree, they've all probably had disappointing starts to the season relative to maybe a best case scenario of their careers. You know, I mean, Westbrook has been in the finals. Harden's been in a conference finals. Melo was in a conference finals way back in the day. And clearly, you know, that's probably not in the cards this year for any of those guys, but at least they've had some say and some power in that. These other guys who I was mentioning and kind of focusing on, they're basically just kind of, you know, drifting in the wind.
Yeah. Well, so who do you think is the most desperate? Because my number one is Carmelo.
Well, because of the age factor?
Yeah, just because I feel like he's in a spot, and he personally may not be that desperate. He seems really happy in New York, and it doesn't seem like winning has definitely been a priority over the last few years, or at least like he made different choices. I think winning, he definitely cares about winning, but I think if you look around that roster and the way those Knicks games feel this year, like he only has two or three more like useful years at this level, at like a superstar level, if that. So as someone who's been a defender of his game for a long time, like I just really want to see him on a team that actually needs him.
If I'm looking at pure desperation, I think I'm actually going to have my number one pick be Anthony Davis. The reason why I say that is because
but
when they finally...
he's so young. Anthony Davis is going to be fine.
Maybe. When they finally won their first game, they beat the Bucks. It was game number 8. So that's, you know, two solid weeks of losing coming after, you know, watching 3 months of losing when he was injured last year, right?
Right.
He pulls Tim Frazier's head to his chest and he just holds it there for like 20 seconds in this exhausted, demoralized embrace, this just gigantic hug of relief. And you're thinking, this guy is 23 years old. Like, he shouldn't be having these feelings over one win for the season. And you kind of think like maybe his interior monologue is, well, if we don't win another one, at least we got one, you know?
That's a much sadder version. Did you ever hear the story about when Magic Johnson won his first game as an NBA player and he celebrated, like, he went crazy on the court and Kareem was like, dude, this is game one. It's like October, relax. And the Anthony Davis scene you just described is a much sadder version of that.
Yeah, it's like Showtime without any of the excitement.
Yeah, exactly. With none of the excitement. All right, so you...
So that's why... But no, but your point is well taken. It's like these are guys who are on different ends of the age curve, right? Like I think Melo is the oldest guy of this group of 8. Davis is the youngest guy. But I think, you know, if you're Davis and you're his representatives, like you can't demand a trade. You're not going to demand a trade. That's just not really fair business at this point. You just signed the contract. You're the guy, right?
Yeah.
But you've got to do everything in your power to kind of make it clear to ownership that you don't want to deal with 5 years of this.
Yeah.
You know, like whether that means.
So basically your argument is that he's the most desperate because he's the most locked in to these, to where he is.
Yeah. He's the most desperate because there's not necessarily an end in sight and that this could wind up defining his entire prime, you know, because we've seen big guys like Dwight Howard, right? Like Dwight Howard was done by 28 or 29, you know, in terms of his MVP level career, right? We know Anthony Davis has had health injury concerns. Am I convinced that Anthony Davis is going to be this amazing player at 34 years old? I'm not. Like, yeah. I'm not convinced
now,
he's going to have a prime as long
really
as LeBron's.
Now you are really scaring me. Now you've succeeded in making me panic about Anthony Davis's future.
But hold on. Like, this is out of love, though. Like, I hope people understand. I'm not trying to crush Anthony Davis here. I think he is, you know, in terms of pure talent level, one of the most amazing players I've ever seen in my life. You just don't want that to be squandered for, you know, the duration of his second contract where he's 27 or 28 coming off multiple injuries and finally able to pick a new place. And, you know, he feels like his career has passed him by.
Yeah, that's fair. When you talk, like, I would do anything to watch him and John Wall on the same team. Because they would just, like, Wall would throw him at least 5 alley-oops a game. It would be a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and I think Wall would just be happier, too. I mean, these warning signs from Wall in terms of bumping the referee, you know, over fouls, tackling Marcus Smart to the court, basically, that's not John Wall. I mean, John Wall at his best is a point guard, much like Westbrook, who's out in the open court putting constant pressure on you and having fun
doing
it.
But he's distributed.
You know?
And it's, I say that because the Wizards actually came really close to winning the lottery that year. They had the 3rd pick and went with Beal, but they were decently close to, making John Wall and Anthony Davis a reality. And I don't even care if it happens in DC. I just want that to happen somewhere. But we should continue with the rankings. So I'll let you have Anthony Davis as, I don't know. He's still so young though. Like they could have a lottery pick, but okay. Anthony Davis, number 1. So would Boogie be your number 2?
I think he has a really strong case for that number 2 spot. And it's a different kind of desperation. It's not the forward-looking desperation. It's the stuck in the same cycle desperation. Yeah. So yeah, I think I'd probably put him number 2.
Okay. So Boogie number 2. you got to let me have Carmelo top three, just because he's taken so much grief over the course of his career, and I don't want that to become his legacy. And we're getting closer and closer to a point where people just think of him as a basketball player who is really talented that you can't win with. And I think that's bullshit, but that's sort of where we are. So, like, I just want him out of there. Whether he goes to play with James Harden in Houston, I kind of would like to see him on the Celtics. I don't know. I mean, where would you want him?
I mean, basically anywhere besides New York. Like, if you're telling me he's going to stand in the way of the 7-foot prodigy, he's going to be stuck with a point guard who's 5 years past his prime, and his defense is going to be entirely reliant upon arguably the worst free agent signing of the summer and Joakim Noah.
Yeah.
I would just hit the eject button and it wouldn't even really matter where he landed. The problem with him though is that the salary contract number is so big that he really has to be at this point, like right now, not 2 years from now, but like right now, he has to be one of your top three guys. And I think if you're a team that's like firmly in the contention mix, I'm not sure that you want to allocate those kind of resources for him. That doesn't mean that he can't win, that he's, you know, he's no longer the same guy, or, you know, these super negative takes, but like that is a big commitment because he really high usage player. He's going to want the ball. You know, defensive impact's not going to be on that sort of like Paul George, Kawhi Leonard level. So when you go down the list of, you know, the Warriors would be fine without him. They're not interested. Cleveland, I think actually at this point is good. I mean, which one of these teams that's really, really going to get Melo excited to play for them is going to want him? I mean, I'm sure the Clippers would welcome him because they have a big hole at three, but like that's not going to work salary-wise, you know?
I know. That's why he was my number one, because I'm like, there aren't very many realistic options for him. I mean, you throw him on the Hornets, and that would make that team a much more realistic threat in the East, first of all. And second of all, he'd be with a coach who actually knows how to get the most out of his top 7 or 8 guys. The problem is, well, I don't see Melo. Can you imagine Melo living in Charlotte all year?
Jordan Brand athlete, so possibly, but yeah, like he and Michael could just be smoking cigars after every single game.
It'd be a tough sell, but yeah.
Well, so here's my thing with these stranded stars. There's always a temptation that if you could just team them up with another one, like if you can just poach Melo and throw him on the Pelicans,
yeah,
all of a sudden, like Davis has some serious help. These two guys are one of the best, you know, star duos in the league, and you know, it might not be perfect fit age-wise, but like at least they'd have a good 3-year run together, right?
For sure.
But how, like, are the Pelicans in such a bad spot they can't even make a compelling trade offer for him, you know?
What about OKC?
I would love that. I mean, again, though, it comes back to like, what would New York want? And then I think if you say Charlotte's a tough sell to Melo, I mean,
I'm sure, yeah.
Melo, It was weird. I didn't see Melo at the Boot Barn or the Banjo Museum when I was there. Maybe he was there. I didn't run across him.
It would take this Knicks season to get even more depressing than it already is for Melo to sign off on a trade to OKC. But OKC has been quietly stockpiling exactly the sort of like half decent assets that you could use for one of these trades where you're trading 50 cents on the dollar. Like, I mean, Oladipo, I could see the Knicks talking themselves into him. Maybe you have to throw in Sabonis, Roberson. Like, once you throw Roberson in the trade, it starts to get more depressing for the Knicks. But I don't know.
I like him, though. I like him as a player, though.
He's useful, right? So there are pieces that they could throw together if they wanted to make that move. And again, it'd take the Knicks season breaking bad to the point where like the popular sentiment is to say, look, this isn't working with Melo. You guys got to do right by him. He wants out, and he's just sick of watching Joakim Noah shoot jumpers in practice.
There is one other scenario here that we probably should mention. It might not happen immediately, but there is a pretty good chance that Luol Deng signing by the Lakers was like the ultimate like chess move, like 2 years, like I know a year from now, 18 months from now, the deadline, a year and a half, like you just use his salary number to send it back for, you know, a high profile small forward, maybe Carmelo Anthony, maybe not. And so the salaries can match. You can plug that hole so that, you know, the other team gets Deng. So it's not like they take this gigantic step back. They've got a veteran to kind of plug in there, and they move forward. So I think, you know, all analysis of the Lakers summer should keep in mind that, like, Deng could potentially be like a lever to get a pretty good player at some point.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that. So,
It's because we were so used to crushing Jim Buss there for like three straight years that we didn't even think about the fact that like Kupchak maybe would have a plan that could work 2 years from now.
Yeah, it speaks to how well they're playing. Once your young guys start to develop and show a little bit of potential, even your dumb moves start to look smart.
the glow of Julius Randle is raising all tides.
Exactly. Mozgov looks great right now. Nick Young looks good. It's just strange things are happening in LA. So, all right. So we got AD, Boogie, Carmelo. Now rank these next three: John Wall, Paul George, Jimmy Butler.
I definitely would have Wall as the most desperate of those three.
Really?
I would, yeah. I mean, Jimmy seems pretty happy at this point. Like, he's got the, you know, there are some benefits, right? Prestige franchise, big market, high profile.
Yeah.
Great looking jerseys. I mean, I'm sure that's not part of his calculation, but he's got some great looking jerseys.
No, and he's also, he's the go-to guy for them.
Yeah, and he's, I mean, they're a destination place. Like, people will want to go, as we saw with Dwayne Wade, you know? I mean, the Bulls can get people. So it never quite feels as hopeless in Chicago as it might feel other places, where, like, if you're Washington, I mean, just the whole organization from top to bottom, even their owner came out and admitted that, like, they're not where they want to be in terms of being, like, professional. Like, do you want to play in those jerseys? Do you want to play in front of fans who are only cheering for chicken? Do you want to play alongside Kelly Oubre? I mean, the list just goes on and on and on and on and on. The answer is probably no to all of those questions. It's just a tough sell, and it's hard even for a super confident, very competitive guy like Wall to just kind of stay above that and pull everybody along with him. And he actually does not get enough credit for how much he turned around the Wizards over the course of like his first like 4 years, five years, right? Like that was, I mean, gun-toting in the locker room, you know, people defecating in shoes. Like, that was a really, really bad place.
It was a really horrible situation. Can you give me 30 seconds to talk on the state of the Wiz right now?
Well, yeah. I mean, do you agree with my Wall assessment, though, that he's next
on
this list?
I kind of do. But at the same time, I'm also, it's really early in the season, and Scott Brooks has impressed me thus far. Just in terms of the way, I mean, the bench has been a disaster. Marcin Gortat said as much this weekend. He said we have one of the worst benches in the league, which is completely true. I mean, there have been a couple games where Marcus Thornton has played like 30 minutes a game, and I've really had to reassess my life choices. And Jason Smith, who, if you had asked me this summer, is Jason Smith still on the league, I would have said, nah, I think I remember him getting dunked on in like 2012 and haven't heard from him since. And he signed a 3-year deal this summer, which, like, even if it had been a 1-year deal, I would have been pretty opposed. But for 3 years, it really makes no sense. And he's getting 15 to 20 minutes a night. So having said all that, Scott Brooks has been really creative and is playing guys like Tomas Satoransky and Sheldon McClellan, who's an undrafted rookie who is good. And he's finding ways to make this work. So if Beal will come back healthy this week and they've got 5 winnable games, if they can win 4 of the 5 winnable games, this season is going to be, I think they'll be in okay shape. So long story short, it's going to depend on the starters to stay healthy. But if the starters stay healthy, I believe that Brooks is going to figure out a way to use the guys on the bench that actually makes sense, and they might be okay. And I wouldn't even think about dealing Wall right now. And if I were Wall, I would still be focused on this year.
For sure. A couple thoughts. Number one, you told me that last week was going to be a big week and that you just had to get above 500. I told you they were going to be 2-8. And now they're 2-7.
You're correct.
So,
yes.
Okay. That did happen. Number two, absolutely about Wall's focus and where it should be and the fact that they shouldn't trade him. The Wizards would be foolish to trade
because
John Wall at this
the
point.
The other thing that we should factor in is that the new CBA is probably going to make it easier for teams to overpay guys to try and keep them. And that might be enough to keep Wall in 2 years.
Yeah, I don't think that they have to worry about Wall's flight risk necessarily quite yet. I think that this is a classic, another situation where the system's kind of broken, right? Like, it's more about how do you build the team around him and to make it work when your market's not an advantage, your team's history is not an advantage. Your other young core lottery guys, I mean, that's really, their whole franchise has relied on Beal and Porter to turn into like big time players, right?
Yeah.
And that hasn't happened yet. So they're stuck. And like, that was their only real method to make this work. Otherwise, you're out there throwing money at Jan Mahimi and, you know, trying to piece together whatever else you can around the edges. And that's why I think he belongs at the next spot on this list of desperation guys, because where does he expect this massive improvement to come from? Like, he told you in his interview that you did with him, which was great. He said, we want to win 50 games. How the hell are they going to win 50 games?
Yeah, no, that's fair. And there's not like a clear path to another guy. And they're going to have to, again, I think I said this a couple podcasts ago, like they should be harassing the Kings every day about stealing Boogie. And we'll see. I would put Paul George above John Wall, though, just because I think he has more of a reason to be frustrated. He's played with some of these elite guys over the summer, and he's unquestionably on that level. And if the Pacers miss the playoffs this year, like, he's going to want out.
Yeah, and so I think that he would be the next one after Wall to me, because I think that part of it is that George is just a better player than John Wall,
yeah.
So that his teams are usually able to kind of like eke by into respectability just sort of based off of his efforts. You know, like, you can make 15 trades around him. They can all be sideways trades. And, you know, you swap out a defensive minded point guard for an offensive minded point guard. You know, you dump one center and you get a different type of center. None of it really matters because George is sort of carrying them, you know, to a certain level of success by himself. That's something we could say about Melo for a number of years too, right?
Right.
So again, it's a different flavor of desperation. It's not the, this is so hopeless, like, I can't make it work desperation. It's the, why do I have to do everything by myself? Why haven't we kind of settled on a vision for even what his position's supposed to be, which was a big question last year for them. And now he's kind of in a position where the one advantage that I think he has over Wall too, Miles Turner could wind up being a stud, right? And if Miles Turner's a stud, then you can really play for something.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't totally see it with Miles Turner. I think he's very good for a young player, but he's not like a 1A, 1B type star where you're just building around those two guys and expecting to contend with the top of the conference. And he's also, he is 20 years old, where I think Paul George is what, like 27?
Yeah, I think he's 26. Well, so here's kind of the thing. If we fast forward to Paul George's free agency, like 18 months from now, right, as of right now, it feels like the story that will be written then is Paul George gave Indiana a chance. They tried everything. They changed coaches. They changed styles. They had some really good times early on in his career that they just couldn't quite recapture. Larry Bird gave it his best shot. And Paul George decided to go to Team X that had a better, you know, either a better market or a better shot to win or a better core group of guys to kind of play with. I mean, doesn't that really kind of feel like the story that will be written?
Definitely. And I mean, it's actually going to be interesting because, again, I expect that teams will be able to pay a lot more money. So he's going to probably have to turn down a lot more money if he wants to leave. And I think he will do that because he's at that level where you're kind of judged by how you do in the playoffs, and he's not getting the help that he needs in Indiana. And the one thing I want to say about George in general is that I've always thought that he's more of like a Scottie Pippen type, and he's unfortunately in Indiana, he's asked to be like a Jordan type or a Kobe or a Kevin Durant, and he's just like, he is so much more dangerous if you can put him next to a scorer. Like, can you imagine Paul George and James Harden together? They would be incredible.
Oh, for sure. that being said, I think if you constructed a really good roster around him, he could be your number one guy on a title team.
Definitely.
I think he's got that in him. I don't think it would look like this Westbrook Harden scenario where these guys are just jacking, you know, 30 points a night every single night.
That's,
I think it would be a little bit different.
It's like he's in a situation where he's asked to score 25 or 30 a night, where I think if you put him on a more balanced, like if you slide him onto the Celtics, like where Isaiah Thomas is creating a lot of offense and his job is to basically defend, hit open shots, move the ball, like he could just be so good. And that, like, over the summer with Team USA is where this really crystallized for me, because Team USA was poorly constructed, struggled in a lot of games. And then when you put Paul George and Kevin Durant on the same, on the floor together, like those two were just unstoppable. And I want that for him before his prime is done.
For sure. And I think one other factor we should mention with all of these guys, but specifically Paul George, is that LeBron James is going to be an amazing player for a long, long time, right? But he's probably not going to be clearly the best player 3 or 4 years from now in the league, right? Like someone's going to have passed him. His skills are going to kind of have, you know, come back to earth a little bit. So you can understand why, like, this past summer, Kevin Durant would say, look, if I want to win a title before, you know, 2020, I got to get moving now and go on a team that can really challenge LeBron, because he is just at that level. But when Paul George is going to be a free agent eyeing his next, you know, 4-year or 5-year contract, the mountain that is LeBron, you know, may not be quite as high, and there may be more opportunities for him to, you know, more situations where he can talk himself into saying, like, look, we could have the best team in the league because LeBron has slipped a certain degree, where, you know, situation starts to take a precedent over money, right? Like, if you feel like you can go sign with the Lakers, for example, and you can win a title there because LeBron, it has come back to earth by 10%, all of a sudden that extra money you might have made staying in Indiana, it might no longer seem like that should be the most important factor.
Well, by the same token, I mean, this is going to come up faster than I think a lot of people realize, because he's going to have a chance to sign an extension this summer. And if he says no, the Pacers are going to have a choice to make in terms of what they want to do with him, whether they want to go the OKC route and just kind of ride things out and see what happens, or move him. And I think that's one of the reasons Larry Bird made so many moves this summer, because this is a big year for them.
That's what I'm saying. Doesn't it seem like they're scrambling? They're in scramble mode of, like, what can we do to show him that we tried everything?
100%. All right. So I think our final rankings here, we're ditching Harden and Russ because they both just signed extensions and they're in good shape for now. Although I would be pretty concerned if I were Harden. But Anthony Davis, number one. Number two, Boogie. They got to trade Boogie at some point.
They really should.
Number three, Carmelo. Number four, I still say Paul George, but we'll put Wall. And then Paul George, 5. Jimmy Butler, 6. Harden, 7. Russ, 8. I love Russ in OKC because I think he's going to get more of a free pass there for his weaknesses than he would get on a better team, where some of the end of game stuff would be an issue. But in Oklahoma City, nobody cares, at least this year. So we'll see.
I also think he's happy.
Yeah,
you know? I think that's a really big part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
like, I think he's totally at terms with his spot in the league. And that is a big part of this desperation meter, is because how could guys like DeMarcus and Anthony Davis be comfortable or content with their current lot in life? I mean, they're so competitive, it's just got to drive them crazy.
Yeah. Well, and also, Russ is on an entirely different level than really any of these guys in terms of celebrity. And that, so market hasn't really affected him. I guess Harden is in the same mix. And Carmelo obviously is in New York. So he doesn't necessarily need to leave to maximize his earning potential. All right, so for most of these early week shows, we're going to go around the league. I honestly didn't. The reason we switched it up a little bit this week is because I didn't watch a whole lot of basketball this weekend. I spent some time with Planet Earth, and I just needed to clear my head a little bit after last week, and it was great. I watched a pirated episode of Planet Earth 2, which you should definitely check out.
Yeah, after you do that, you guys should really look at the Lego architecture set. Some of America's and actually the world's finest tourist destinations are in Lego form. I spent the weekend building the Buckingham Palace. I built the Buckingham Palace and I built the Louvre. Both, you know, were great mental cleansing exercises.
That's right.
And highly recommended.
It's great. It's great. Whatever it takes. But what about some of the, give me three notes from watching hoops this weekend or hearing about it.
Yeah, number one, Andrew Wiggins. I mean, he went off, right? 47. I thought this was his ceiling. The first time I watched him play, I was like, wow. I mean, this guy could really score the ball a lot of different ways. I was impressed. I mean, clearly the number was really inflated by his outside shooting. I mean, he was hitting a lot of tough shots and hitting some three-pointers too.
Yeah.
But this, he's really got the Euro step going. He's got a knack for getting to the free throw line. He's starting to look stronger on the ball. This is a seriously positive development. We haven't talked a ton about him this season. Numbers are looking pretty good. Minnesota, you know, more important than the playoff push or the win total or whatever was getting clear step forwards from Towns and Wiggins when you're looking at their big picture. And I think this is a milestone for him. You know, it's kind of one of those things you look back on and maybe he can kind of convince himself like, yeah, I mean, you could do it in this league. Like, you're still incredibly young to put up that kind of a point total at that age. It's impressive. So that was my biggest takeaway, I think, from the weekend. Oh, the other one, Serge Ibaka. Did you see his Oklahoma City homecoming?
I did. I think that's probably the best Serge Ibaka is going to look all year.
He should have just retired. Like, I really thought that. I was like, just walk off the court. You're done. It's not going to get better than that.
What were his numbers?
I want to say he had a career high 31, you know, probably pretty good rebounding total. He had a couple of blocks on one play, just back-to-back, that were great. And then, of course, he hits the game-winning jumper with 0.4 seconds. It's, like, perfectly scripted. And then on top of that, he was doing all of his hand signals, you know, like the no, 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 and the thumbs down hand signals. I mean, he probably felt really, really, really good after that
game. Can I make one point though about that game? It's like I understand it was a revenge game for him, but if the narrative is that OKC marginalized him and that's why he wasn't putting up numbers over the last few years, like, I don't know if that's true, because if you look at the rest of Ibaka's year in Orlando, it seems like he's just taken a couple steps back. And that's the player he is now. So I kind of get what happened with OKC. Like, he wasn't on the same level.
I trust the Thunder's ability to kind of put their guys in position. Like, they were desperate for third options for like five straight years, right?
Yeah.
And at times that was absolutely Ibaka. I mean, he filled that role really well. And I think he just had a really bad year last year and they weren't going to ride him if he was not playing well.
Right.
And so I think when he leaves, he probably has a different version of events. But I think ultimately, like, the Thunder side of that story was, well, took a big step back. We sold before his stock crashed, and we're moving forward with Sabonis and these other young guys. And I think that the Thunder are going to come out ahead. You know, history is going to favor the Thunder's version of that exchange.
Right, especially if they can flip Oladipo for another star. But we'll see. And, I mean, Oladipo's been better after like a pretty rough start. What about what you mentioned at the start, the Klay Thompson Celtics stuff? What?
Yeah.
Was that just a Twitter thing?
I think Brian Scalabrine got himself in some trouble because I think he was just repeating like nonsense, like, you know, Facebook rumors or whatever. And then people started to try to run with it. But you know how the Celtics are. I mean, they're linked to every single team in rumors. They're trying to trade for you, I heard.
That's true. Someone on the internet.
That wasn't serious.
Maybe one of us should do it. But we should put together a collection of every Celtics trade rumor from the past like 3 to 4 years. I think it would probably be 10,000 words long.
We should just do, instead of the top 100 players in the NBA list that we do in September, we should just do the top 100 Celtics trade targets.
Yeah,
and then just rank
exactly.
them all. It'd be exactly the same list.
Yeah, no question. Yes, I think we can both agree that Klay is not getting traded this month.
Hey, here's my third note, and this is just kind of a random basketball geek note.
Uh-huh.
So the Clippers are playing really well, right?
For sure.
One thing that I have loved from Blake, and I kind of mentioned right at the end, like, he had a nice game against the Spurs last week, but this has kind of been a consistent theme for him. Okay, so first of all, his defensive intensity is way better than it's been in years. I mean, he's really putting in multiple effort plays. He's rotating much harder, protecting the rim better. I mean, he's not a natural rim-protecting guy. His wingspan isn't crazy, but he's doing better on that end. The other thing I'd say, though, is, and I wish more big men would do this, Blake is excellent at establishing position early in transition or even like semi-transition scenarios where he runs the court hard. And if he's the guy who picks him up in transition smaller than him, he is really, really skilled at keeping that guy on his back, getting on the block, and then just begging for the basketball to be pushed ahead and thrown to him so that he can kind of get a one-on-one against either a smaller defender, a guy who's out of position, or, you know, basically just take it to that guy and get a quick foul call.
Yeah.
We need to see more of this from the mobile big man. Run the floor, get up there, and your guards will look for you. And then the cool secondary benefit of that is that when they do feed the ball to him, watch how quickly the defenses freak out and just all suck down onto him. And then that's when Blake can kind of just kick the ball right back out, that inside-outside pass right to a shooter, and they've got Redick trailing. You know, sometimes they've got Chris trailing. And it really just creates pretty consistent offense for them on almost a nightly basis when he's just running the floor and doing that early. So, you know, the Clippers 9-1, it's remarkable. And, you know, I think Blake being back, Chris playing very well, I mean, that's kind of where it starts. But that's just one little thing I've been seeing from Blake that's nice to see. Because
they have managed their minutes really, really well. I mean, those guys are playing like low 30s and still blowing teams out.
Yeah, that's the thing. The games are done halfway through the third quarter, so it's like, all right, guys, call it a night.
Yeah, you know?
And that's happened to them. That's happened to them a couple of times, and the bench has played well, which really helps that because they're not in these situations where they go up 15, blow it, and have to build another lead in the third quarter. So, the vibes around Clippers, at least the last game I went to, were exceedingly positive. And I think what I was mentioning about Blake, though, running the floor like that, it's a sign that he's back to good health too, and you like to see that because. That was a tough year.
That was not at all a guarantee. I think certainly coming into the year, one of the biggest questions I had with the Clippers was whether Blake was going to be 100% and play 6 months straight at the level that he was 2 years ago, where he was like kind of MVP-ish. And it's great to see him back there. Yeah, like that. I've been blown away. I still need to watch more Clippers. One of the things that I'm a little bit wary of with them is like their bench is better than it's ever been with Doc at LA, but there are still guys on there that like I don't totally trust to hold up the entire year. Like Raymond Felton's playing really well. I love Raymond Felton, but I don't know if I totally trust him. Jamal Crawford, again, like Jamal Crawford straight up is one of my favorite players of all time, but like I think he's like 38 years old at this point. And Spates is another guy. They're all just very streaky, and it'll be interesting to see whether they keep this going and if this is just the new normal for them.
100% fair question. And also, like, let's say game six, you know, 4-point game late in the third quarter. I mean, how many of those guys do you want on the court?
Yeah.
You know, at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, Wesley Johnson's another guy who's playing really well right now. So, like, we'll see if this continues. Did you see these supervillains balloons from the Warriors?
I did. That made me want a drone. I know that's a nerdy response. Like, I didn't even care about the message or, like, any of the debate. It's like,
you just want to spy on Steph's backyard?
No, like that drone looks awesome. Like I want to fly that around and take pictures with a drone.
Oh, wait. So that's how they took the picture?
Maybe I'm confused, but I thought JaVale McGee was holding the controls to a drone and the photo was taken with the drone of the players.
Wow.
Was that not what happened?
No, that is probably what happened. I only saw a picture and didn't really like read into the backstory. And JaVale McGee definitely seems like one of the three or four players in the NBA who's most likely to own a drone. So,
he definitely has a drone collection.
Yeah.
He's got 10 drones. I mean, there's no question.
Yeah, that was some of the corniest. I don't know. I saw that and wondered how many teams around the NBA were like currently going to town making fun of those guys. Because like if that pops up and you're on a team plane, like the entire roster will go in on what the Warriors are doing. So.
Yeah, I thought that too. And I also thought like villain, that was not the right time to have the villain.
And they're
term,
just
you know,
not
given...
really the villains. Like, I don't know, man. Like, they're fine, but don't try to be something you're not.
Yeah, I don't really see like Steph wearing the black cape when he gets 13 three-pointers in one game. Yeah.
Like it's a different vibe with them. They're not the 2011 Heat. I think people might be more annoyed with the Warriors than like fearful or hateful. My other note, I think in the preview this year, we talked about the Nets and we said, I think this is probably the only time we'll mention the Nets all year. But those guys have been pretty good.
Well, I know they have because our SI video producer, Dave Sepperson, is the last remaining Nets fan. I just did a video this morning. And I honestly think he just scheduled me on the show so he could like talk crap about the Nets to me for like 15 minutes about how they're this great team and Brooke Lopez's trade values through the roof. And they're our new modern offense, overachieving. And I had to remind him they don't really have a quality win yet.
Yeah, but I don't know. They won at Phoenix on Saturday night. And
okay.
Phoenix is a quality win to me. I really believe in the Suns. But Rondé Hollis-Jefferson is started to show signs. They've won a couple games without Jeremy Lin. I don't know. Kenny Atkinson, I am officially pissed off that the Wizards didn't hire him.
Here's my Nets take. So my watchability rankings, number one was Golden State this year. Brooklyn was number 30. I actually think that Cleveland might be the most watchable team this year, given how well they're moving the ball and the kind of just like joyful, you know, when they turn it on, it's really, really fun to watch. And then I think that Brooklyn's pretty clearly not the worst team to watch this year. Like, I think there's other teams that are out there that are worse. So at the top and the bottom of the watchability scale, I'd say we've got some shakeups.
Yeah. One of the issues with watching Brooklyn is they still play on that in that weirdly dark arena and their uniforms are still ugly. But that is, they're still playing well. So whatever. Any final thoughts here?
I don't factor into account. Yeah, I don't factor aesthetics into the conversation. Well, I think we should be focusing on basketball.
They're the league pass rankings. It's all about aesthetics.
All right.
Final thoughts?
Those are my real takeaways. Did you see the fight between Cousins and Myers-Leonard? Well, not really a fight, but just the ongoing jawing and pushing. That's one of the most underrated beefs. Like, Myers-Leonard and DeMarcus Cousins hate each other, deeply.
Yeah. The other one is Chris Paul and DeMarcus Cousins. That's less underrated, but watching those two go head-to-head is nonstop entertainment.
Hey, can we also give a shout-out to the Sixers
for
the third year in the row?
Nope.
For
the
third year
in a row.
For the third year in a row, they were the last remaining winless team. But they got off the schneid, 1-8. They beat the Pacers. Congratulations. They too, like the Pelicans, will not finish 0-82.
Great. I draw the line at talking about the Nets. I'm not ready to acknowledge the Nets and the Sixers in the same podcast. But yo, we got to go. I have to leave right now. Tweet questions at us because for Friday's show, we're going to do a mailbag. I will tweet out a reminder, but between now and Friday, hashtag open floor, and we'll answer them on the show. And thank you to Mac Weldon for sponsoring us and for hooking us up with I'm currently wearing their sweatpants, so it's all good.
They look great on you. Yeah. I mean, they're really flattering. They look great on you. MacWeldon.com, promo code open.
All right. I'll talk to you Friday, man.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.